and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubenstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Hi everyone, how are you all? I hope that your week is going well. First things, a little bit of housekeeping. A heads up that if you listen to this podcast on Google Podcasts, then as far as I'm aware, it's shutting down. So please make sure that you subscribe on another podcast app when you can. I'm on all the podcast apps, as you know. So I'm about to tell you about the most amazing hotel that I stayed in Lisbon. If you haven't visited Lisbon, let me tell you that it will just go straight into your top three favorite cities when you visit it. I can almost guarantee it. It's the perfect size. It has amazing restaurants. It's colorful. It's beautiful, not just in parts, but like every corner you turn, the streets are covered in beautiful tiles. The iconic trams are going up and down the hills. It's by the water. And I wanted to give a thank you to the Four Seasons Ritz Lisbon who hosted us while we were there. It was such a treat to stay there. A very different experience of the last time I was in the city because it's a bigger hotel. I stayed in a small apartment last time. And to have that space and the facilities of essentially a resort, but in the city, you know, an indoor pool, a massive spa, multiple restaurants, a stunning outdoor pool, which in the summer would be so nice to retreat to, having done, you know, a day's city exploring and relax beside. It has the most incredible running track on the roof and a gym on the roof too that has these 270-degree views of the city. I mean, the most incredible views. I said on Instagram, I'm petitioning for that running track to be turned into a bar so that more people could actually take in that view. But if you visit the hotel, you must go up on the roof. And with a family, it certainly was such a luxury to have those facilities. The rooms look out over the park and the city, and they had a really calm quality about them. And if you're planning to visit Lisbon and you're a foodie, I can't recommend more highly the restaurant there called Cura. It holds a Michelin star, so it's one for a special dinner. If you really want to get a flavor of seasonal local ingredients, there were such unusual combinations like squid spaghetti with hazelnuts and this dessert of ice cream and caramelized meringue and then frozen sweet peas, like the vegetable, which I'll always remember. It was so unusual and delicious. And we spent a few nights there before heading back. Four Seasons is really close to the airport, so it's super convenient. If you'd like to see more about my trip to Lisbon and the Four Seasons, head to my Instagram at Holly Rubenstein. Right, on to today's guest. Susanna Constantine first burst onto our TV screens in the late 90s alongside her partner in style, Trini Woodall. Together, they revolutionized the way women approach fashion with their groundbreaking show, What Not to Wear, and became the iconic duo known as Trini and Susanna. The series not only garnered international acclaim, but also became a cultural phenomenon, empowering women to embrace their bodies and dress with confidence. And it took them all over the world, from the Oprah Winfrey Show to the Oscars red carpet. This, we discuss, was just one chapter in Susanna's really unusual and fascinating life. For example, in her 20s, she was in a long-term relationship with Viscount David Linley, the son of Princess Margaret. And we chat today about her travels with, you know, the extended royal family and how she viewed Princess Margaret very much as a mother figure in her life. Susanna is also, of course, a best-selling author and a very successful podcaster. Her podcast, My Wardrobe Malfunction, has had 9 seasons now, and it has the most incredible guest lineup. I think it's the best celebrity guest lineup of any podcast, in my opinion. From, you know, Elizabeth Hurley to Kristen Scott Thomas to Nile Rodgers. It is such a fun listen, and it's all about the moments when our clothes let us down badly. Travel, quite clearly, means a lot to Susanna, and she evokes the destinations in her travel diaries today, from Cornwall to Canada, Pakistan to Antarctica, so vividly and emotively. So let's buckle up and get started. Here's Susanna Constantine. Susanna Constantine, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It is so, so lovely to see you today. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I am really good, Holly, and I am so thrilled to be on this podcast because I've listened to it for ages. It's one of my go-to, and I do listen to it. I listen to it at night. And annoyingly, it does keep me awake. It doesn't send me to sleep, thank goodness. But I love it. It's so interesting, so, and we can be taken off, you know, around the world virtually and through our ears. It's wonderful.
That is extremely flattering coming from you, Susanna, as a fellow podcaster, a podcast queen. And you're just back from a huge adventure. You were in Antarctica.
Trip of a 61-year-old lifetime. And it was, and we went with Viking Cruises, and on one of their expedition ships, Octantis. And you know when you, it's like a bit like when you go to Venice for the first time, it exceeds all expectation. This was the same going to Antarctica, but tenfold. It was extraordinary.
I can't wait to ask you about it. I know that it's one of your Travel Diaries chapters today.
Yes, it is.
I'm really curious because it is very, very popular as a top of the bucket list destination. It's really come onto the radar, I think, kind of halfway through me having launched the podcast, actually. You know, it has become more accessible. There are more ships. So it'll be, I can't wait to hear more about it. But first, Susanna, what kind of traveller are you, would you say?
I love to travel.
Yeah.
I love to travel, even if it's just for a night and it's for work and I'm staying in a shitty little hotel somewhere. It doesn't matter. I love the freedom. I love the isolation. I love being on my own, having my own space, being in my little shitty hotel room and making it my own with a little scented candle. And I don't care where I go. I just love traveling. Always have done.
Sounds like you are my perfect guest then.
I am your perfect guest.
And we're going to go on a journey today through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diary, Susanna. And we're going to start at the very beginning. Chapter 1 is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
That would be the south of France, and in particular Gassin, which is a tiny, weeny little village behind Saint-Tropez. And my parents bought the equivalent of a doll's house. It was two up, two down. And it was in the corner of this street, this little corner, cobbled street. And we used to go every year. And I have such happy memories of being in this. It was sort of like a fairy tale, because you had all these beautiful stone buildings everywhere, and it was on a hill, and you'd walk up to the top. I remember with my dad at night, he'd take me and my sister up to the top, and there'd be this terrace with all the old men playing boule, and then there was a pinball machine in the cafe, and we'd go up and look at the stars. And it was just, again, the smells. For me, smell is so important when I'm
so
traveling.
So evocative, unless it's, especially in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, really amazing. And I remember, I don't know if you remember, if they still make them, they had these little toffee sweets called Caramac, and you unwrap them. Smell of that, and the smell of bread, and the smell of croissant, and I'm salivating as I invoke memories of that time.
Sounds absolutely magical. Such a beautiful energy and light in that part of France.
Absolutely. My father was an amazing artist. We have loads of his paintings here, and he was offered exhibitions all over the world, but never took up the offer. I think probably
really?
Because
wow.
He was scared of failure. looking back, but he loved that part of the world because, exactly right, because of the light and the rock formations and the colour of the soil, you know, that sort of rich soil against the whiteness, the sort of pale rock and stone. And that was something that never left me, actually, to have, you know, I say it's the smells, but also it is to go places where you find that light. The clarity of that light is really wonderful.
And what would a typical day on one of your holidays look like?
Well, we'd go up to, my sister and I would go up to the bakery and we'd get the croissant and the bread, and then we'd have that with butter, both the croissant and the bread with butter and apricot jam. All my memories come back through food. If ever I go into a coma, you're just going to have to wave a plate of sausages under my nose and I'll come round. But so we go and do that, and then we pack up, we take a picnic. We always have picnic. We'd get like pizza, slices of pizza, cold pizza. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we'd make, my sister and I would make sandwiches with very dark chocolate, so French bread, baguette with dark chocolate and salt-free butter in it, and we'd take drinks. And then sometimes we go to a beach called Pomplon, which is now a notorious gay beach, and I have been back there since. It's fantastic. But there was no one there, so we used to go down there, and we had a little boat called, little fishing boat called the Pistou, after the soup, and we'd go out fishing, and you just drop your little fishing line in, and we'd pull up sardines. And there was a restaurant on Pomplon Beach, which we used to go to a lot. We'd have sardines and frites and orangina or a Coke if we were lucky. And I, you know, the French Coca-Cola tastes so much better than anywhere else. Still today, you can taste the difference.
Totally. But also an orangina. I have to say, I was going to hone in on the orangina. For me, that is the drink of a summer, European summer holiday.
So true. I so agree, Holly. And then I remember we used to, you know, it was all like we'd just be in our little bikini bottoms and we'd play boule on the sand as well. And I remember I always used to, my mum would have her handbag beside her, and I remember we should go for a swim, and I'd go to her handbag and I'd take out some francs, as they were then, take out a few francs, and then I'd go and put them in the sand, and then I'd kind of be making a sandcastle in parentheses. And I go, oh my gosh, look what I found, these francs. Can I go and buy an ice cream? So I always used to do that.
And so it was happy just, at such a young age.
I know, it was sort of a thief. I became quite well-attuned at thievery. But it was a very simple life, you know, very simple. And that stayed with me. It's the simplicity, it's being outdoors, it's being, obviously when you're by the sea, you're in nature. But it was just, you know, everything revolved around the beach, our little fishing boat, food, and going to bed and sleeping, and that was it.
Sounds so restful, like the perfect summer holiday.
Yeah, and Saint-Tropez was so stunning then. It was, you know, the whole Brigitte Bardot era. And I still remember the shops. There was a shop called Shows where I'd go with my mum, and I got an amazing belt from there, which I've still got. Even my daughters can't get into it. It's so tiny. Put it around their waist. It's so tiny, but I still have it. And all those wonderful kind of 1950s cowl collared shirts in really heavy cotton, which became kind of washed and faded. Mm. And then there was an amazing ice cream shop next door to Shows where we'd get pistachio and chocolate ice cream and a cone, or chocolate and lemon sorbet. And it was so different. It was empty. There were none of those big ships. And we were staying with a great friend of ours who we go and stay with every year in Nice. And we decided to go on a jaunt, which we've done a few times. First time we drove, and it took 3 hours to get down the waterfront. And I was sobbing in the back of the car. And my friend said, Susanna, what's wrong with you? And I said, I just, you know, this is my first travel memory from when I was a child. And it's like being on the M25 at 6:30 on a Friday night.
Yeah.
I found it very upsetting. But then we went back another time on a boat, and that was better. But it's so much money there, which I find, and people looking at each other, the sort of one-upmanship, which
it's very showy in the summer, isn't it?
Yeah.
So now I think it's a place that is best visited in a kind of out of season, shoulder season, when you can actually see largely just locals and the beaches are that bit more calm. I went in late September to that part of the world a couple of years ago, and all the flashiness had long departed, and it felt like I was able to get much more of an authentic experience as a result. So yeah, I think shoulder season.
Yeah, I must do that and go back. But I love that shoulder season. I've never heard of that. But you still got, you know, Chanel. This used to be a little tiny fishing village, and you have Chanel and Gucci and all these super brands. There's nothing apart from the food again, and maybe, you know, a sort of lavender shop which sells soap and little clothes bags and stuff. There's nothing authentic there, really.
It's wild, isn't it? It's funny how brands kind of hone in on certain destinations. I was just in Comporta, in coastal Portugal, which by all accounts was essentially just two little streets, absolutely minuscule, beautiful, untouched golden sand beaches. But interestingly, there was a Villebrequin there. There was, you know, in these tiny two little streets, the designers were making their mark, and the hype in the travel press is that it's, you know, the next Hamptons of Europe.
I think that's where Princess Eugenie and her husband are building a house there, or got a house there. Probably shouldn't say that, but that's what I heard through the grapevine.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, because I think that there have been rules in place that you can't build there for a really long time, and they've been relaxed somewhat, and it does have exquisite beaches. But yes, it is interesting, isn't it?
It's an amazing part of the world. I went there last year to stay with one of my best friends, to Olia. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. And I was blown away. It reminded me very much of south of France, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully we could get a glimpse of it now before it changes too much.
Yeah.
Speaking of Princess Eugenie, when I was looking back at your life thus far, I feel as though you've lived lots of lives. Do you feel like that a bit?
I do, actually. And I'm not someone who ever looks back over my life, and like categorically never. And it's when I wrote my memoir, which I vowed I would never stoop that low and write a memoir. And then I did. And the way it came around was I went public about being an alcoholic, and it sort of got a lot of press, and a lot of people were reaching out to me, which was amazing. And I thought, why, you know, could I have prevented becoming an alcoholic? And so I started looking back at my life, and then it was just so surprising, all these people who I'd met and places I'd been. And it was, my life has been a sort of set of incidents based in social history, prominent social history. And it was really fascinating, because I'd forgotten it all. So it was really good to look back.
You know, it feels like that first period of your life, which you've spoken about a lot, about when you were essentially part of the extended royal family, weren't you, as David Linley, Princess Margaret's son's other half for several years. And got to travel to some really exciting and unusual places that most people wouldn't get to experience.
I went to Mustique with his mother, David, and I. We went, you know, I probably went there kind of five or six times. And back then, it genuinely was like a desert island. You landed, you never put on a pair of shoes from that moment on. It was so relaxed and so chilled. And yes, you know, there was some very big money starting to come in, but it wasn't that thing of, oh, well, I'm going to Mustique, like it was a badge of honor. It was, you know, oh, I'm going away and I'm going to get a tan and I can't wait. But thank God I only need to pack a bikini and a sarong and some good books. So it was very different from what I've heard it is today. She loves snooping around people's houses. So David Bowie had a house there, and she'd get the key. She was like Mrs. Danvers. She sort of virtually had a master key for every house on the island. And we went to his house and snooped around. And I remember her saying,
"Do you not have any?" So there's no security.
No security. And yeah. She went, "Oh, well, this was looking very nice in downtown Tokyo." So because it was sort of Balinese kind of esque, and that was her sort of put down, really, of not particularly approving of how it was decorated. But it was, yeah, no one. It was like everyone was equal. Everyone was just themselves. But again, you know, we got to meet amazing people and just sort of hang out. What a privilege, you know.
Yeah,
it really was.
With the royal family, like, when they're on Princess Margaret was on her holidays. From your experience, are they able to relax? I mean, are they then just like any other family?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about, yes, but you know, I went to Balmoral a couple of times, and yes, they are like any other family, chilling out, you know, having a holiday.
Yeah. That's the thing that I think would be kind of interesting, because ultimately what we see from the outside is, you know, formality. But when people go on holiday, that's just when you get to be the real you.
Yeah, I don't think you become the real you. I think the few that members of the royal family I met, they were never not themselves. You know, that was, especially Princess Margaret, she was always herself. And that was something to be, that I hugely admired about her. She was unapologetically herself all the time. But I think it is that thing of not having to, you know, get the hairdryer out and put your makeup on and just to be free. To be liberated from being watched.
Which I guess is the same with any famous person, just not having to bother with the glam and the glam squad and, you know, all of that just to go out the door. But she was a real maternal figure for you.
She was. She was an amazing woman. My mum, very sadly, suffered badly from bipolar disorder. And when I met David and started going out with him and met his mother, her illness was at its height. And I think you always, it's like when you're going out, when you're kind of, you have your first big love, you know, you leave home sort of emotionally to a certain degree, but you're still not emotionally adult enough to be completely independent. So it's really beneficial if you have a boyfriend or girlfriend that you really like their parents, because you still feel, oh, you know, I'm quite independent. But actually, you've just transferred your trust into another set of parents. Yeah. And that's what happened with Princess Margaret. And I found that I could be completely honest with her, literally about everything. And she reciprocated. And I think probably, you know, there's a lot of people who have something to gain about, you know, being friends with a member of the royal family, or, you know, there's people want things all the time, which is natural. But I had nothing to gain apart from, you know, she was just my boyfriend's mum. But she was very supportive. And I think she saw this sort of vulnerability in me. And, you know, she was like a warm hug to me all the time. I felt very safe with her. And she was the person who, you know, I'd never had an opinion in my life before I met her, because that wasn't how, you know, I was brought up, being a child of the 60s. You know, women were just set up to be married, and that was it. But she taught me to have opinions and gave me the courage to have opinions and stand by them. And that was a big gift.
It's interesting when you said she was unapologetically herself, because when you said that, I thought that's exactly how I think of you, as somebody being unapologetically authentic. And it was funny that was how you described her, and that you then looked up to her, because I really feel that you imbued with those similar values.
That's so true, Holly. I've never thought of that. And you're probably right.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I feel quite emotional about that. I miss her.
Yeah. Can imagine what a special relationship, an unusual relationship to have had. And someone that you clearly loved, chapter two then. Mm-hmm. the first place that you fell in love with. Where comes to mind for that in your travel diaries?
The first place I really fell in love with was Canada. And Ooh. In particular, British Columbia.
Yeah.
And divine down a little bit more, 400 miles north of Vancouver, mm-hmm. near a town called Clinton. Mm-hmm. And my father's business, I mean, I had a really fucking privileged upbringing. It had its emotional poverty, but it was, you know, I was extremely, extremely lucky. But his company that he worked for had a ranch out there, imaginatively called the OK Corral. And we'd go there every summer. And there we'd fly into Vancouver, and then, you know, we'd stop over on Vancouver Island and go out and see the orcas and catch sea trout. And then we'd drive, you know, do the long drive up to Clinton. And then from there we'd go over to the ranch, which was on the Fraser River. And it was beautiful. It was wild. It was proper, authentic cowboys and Indians, because the, you know, Native Americans, because there was a reservation on mm-hmm. the ranch. And
oh, really?
It was extraordinary. You know, we had the Fraser River, we go panning for gold. And I found actually quite a big nugget, which you have to remember, Diacom for upset stomachs. Diacom.
And yes, they used to come in a little tub.
Yeah. And I put the nuggets that I found in there to smuggle it back to England, because I thought, you know, I was probably only about 13, 14, thought that, you know, I was literally going to be smuggling a trunk load of bullion. And then it got thrown out, which was a real shame. But
no.
So we'd go out riding, we'd go and do the boundaries of the ranch, which was, you know, it was probably about 100 square miles. And go and check the ranch. It was a cattle ranch. Go and check all the boundaries on horses. And I had a horse which I used every year called Dolly, who was enormous. I mean, she must have been about 17 hands, and I just looked like this little dot on top of her. And then there was Bessie there, who was, you know, she was with the reservation, and she was a real mother figure. Amazing, lovely, lovely woman. And her kids, we all played with them. And it was, again, it was just a smell. It was a different kind of smell. So certain times of year, you'd go when the hay was being cut, and it was like clover hay. So it was very rich and green smelling, a lot of clover in the grass. So it was very nutritious for the cattle. And then the dust in later on in the summer. And my dad would come out, and my dad's name was Joe, and he was known as Smokey Joe, because he'd always sit on the back of his horse, who was called Delaware. He was a piebald, and he'd always have a fag hanging out of his mouth, always. And then he'd have a gun over his back, because there were a lot of bear there at that time, and mountain lions, cougars. So that was for safety. And we'd camp out under the stars. And I remember swimming you go for a swim in a lake, and as you swam, you'd just be drinking the water because it was so clear. I mean, this sounds, I didn't put this in my book.
So idyllic.
It's amazing. It sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm really not. And then we'd tickle trout. You know, the trout would be just resting in the shadows in this little stream, and you go and tickle them. We learned how to tickle them, and then they'd flip over, and you'd just scoop them up out of the stream onto the bank. Yeah, so that was the first place I fell in love with.
Wow, what an unusual trip. I mean, also what an unusual destination for a Brit to travel to. I can't imagine that could have been very much on the radar of British travellers at that time.
Not at all. And this is like kind of, you know, mid to late 70s.
Yeah.
And I to this day, I don't really know why, you know, what benefit there would have been. Business-wise, I think it must have been some sort of tax dodge or something.
Yeah. And we're talking about the chapter where we are falling in love. Of course, we first fell in love with you as part of the iconic Trini and Susanna duo, a piece of TV history on BBC's What Not to Wear. So for those who don't know, or maybe those who weren't born, as actually it was quite a long time ago now.
30 years ago or something when we started.
Absolutely,
yeah.
I can't believe that. Bonkers. Cannot believe I can remember it so clearly. How did the show come about for the two of you?
We had a column in the Daily Telegraph which was called Ready to Shop. And that was the first time there had been real fashion for real women, clothes worn by Trini and I, who weren't models, done in a amateur fashion. And not only, we also said what we didn't like as well as what we liked. And no one had ever done that before. And then we started doing bits and pieces on television for, you know, we'd do This Morning. And mm-hmm. and then the BBC approached us to do a fashion show, yeah. which turned out to be What Not to Wear.
And this was a hit of kind of stratospheric levels, wasn't it? I mean, it took you all over the world. It took you to Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
I just was watching some clips of you guys on Oprah.
Oh, can you find them? I have yeah. to see that. That's hilarious.
So goodness. you were discussing what qualifies as a flat butt. that was the bit. What was it like kind of hitting the big time so quickly and going all over the world and meeting people like Oprah? Was it totally surreal?
No, it wasn't. And I think the reason it wasn't, we never kind of understood or appreciated our success while we were in it. And I think that's because we had no kind of road. We'd never put together a business plan or a roadmap or anything. So there was nothing that we were ticking off the list. It happened very organically. And I think the fact that it happened when we were older, so, you know, I was sort of 33, 34, Trini a bit younger. And I think that had a huge difference. And for us, it was work. You know, we were going out to work like we'd always done. It just happened to be on television. And, you know, the first time we went on television was in the UK doing live TV, and that was on This Morning. And that was terrifying. I mean, I probably went and I had to go to the loo probably about six times before I did that. I was so frightened, you know, liquefied my bowels.
Yeah.
And then we just got used to it. We got used to it, and it was exhausting. It was exhausting, but it was exhilarating. And what we both loved more than anything, I mean, Trini loved fashion much more than I did, although that had previously been in my, you know, was in my background. I worked with various designers, you know, including John Galliano. But I was much more interested in how clothes were made than what was in fashion. Right. And Trini loved that. And I was more interested in how clothes could change the way someone felt about themselves. And so that worked beautifully. And that's what we really loved. We were so rewarded by that, seeing a woman and sometimes a man just blossom in front of our eyes with, you know, using clothes as the conduit to do so.
Yeah. Do you find that people even now maybe think more about what they wear when they see you because they don't want you to think what not to wear?
People do, I'm sure, with Trini, but with me, I swear to God, most days I look like I've crawled out from under a stone. And it's not because I don't love clothes still. I do love clothes. And I know that I can, you know, turn up the volume, the sartorial volume, if I need to. And I know how to do that. But it's not my lifestyle anymore. You know, I'm a mum, I'm a wife, I'm a housewife. I live in the countryside, but I also happen to work. So I'm now living the life I think I probably would always have lived had we not had the sort of TV diversion. And it's the life that I feel most happy living in, where I am today.
Well, that leads us perfectly on to chapter three, which is the place where you learnt the most about yourself.
The place I learnt the most about myself was Pakistan.
Oh, wow.
And I went there quite a few times. The first time I went there was in about 1988, I think. And it was Not somewhere I ever in a million years thought I would go, but I had a Pakistani boyfriend. And I promise you, it was the first place I ever felt I was home.
Really?
I completely fell in love with that country. I fell in love with the people, the beauty. We went up all through the Northern Territories, up to the Northwest Frontier, and Lahore, Islamabad, Karachi, into Sindh, into Balochistan, all over. And I just love the country and I love the people really, really passionately. And I didn't, I went into Sindh and met, you know, right in staying in these villages and things. And these people, they're so generous spirited. They have so much pride. And they're so kind of elegant, but in themselves, you know, they had real sense of self-worth and pride. And then I also, that's where I fell in love with cricket, falling in love with cricket led me to my career with Trini in a weird way.
Really?
So first article I ever wrote was in the Daily Telegraph because I'd met the sports editor of the Telegraph, who very strangely was called David Welsh. And the sports editor today is another David Welsh, but my David Welsh.
Yeah.
He very sadly passed away, and he had a son, Christopher, who nearly died of a brain tumour had it not been for the gifted hands of a neurosurgeon called Peter Hamlin. And Peter was setting up a foundation called the British Brain and Spine Foundation. And I was brought on to go and help him do the PR for it. And so I was put in touch with David Welsh, and he knew about my connection with Pakistan and the Pakistani cricket team and how much I love them. And he asked me to write peripheral pieces. So that's how I got about cricket for the Telegraph, and that's how I got embedded into the Telegraph. And then I started writing about cars, and then the motoring editor became editor of the weekend section, and then he asked me to write a fashion page.
Isn't it funny how these things,
you know,
things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
So this was during your relationship with Imran Khan, for people who don't know the context of that. And so just tell me a little bit more about Pakistan for people who might not ever consider it as an obvious place that they would book a holiday.
I think if you're going to go to Pakistan, you go to see the beauty. You go to see into the Karakoram Mountains. Mm. And you do the, what's it called, the something highway.
The Karakoram Highway as well.
The Karakoram Highway, which hadn't been built when we were there. Literally, we were driving up the supposed highway, and the whole road had fallen down the mountainside, and we'd be getting out and putting rocks back so that the Pajero could get over, and then we'd have to walk for miles. But I think that it's all pretty efficient now, and it has become certainly a great destination for Pakistanis, and they go there. It's sort of almost
a climbing destination.
The big climbing destination, but beautiful. The climate, you know, in the summers are brutal, as you can imagine. And to get up into cooler climes, you know, we went through Swat, we went to Hunza, we went to Gilgit, to Skardu, we crossed the Dosai Plain from the Himalayas into the Karakorams. We climbed mountains in trainers and met German climbers, and they thought we'd sort of were like aliens and that we'd materialize. They said, "How have you climbed that mountain without any crampons and ropes?" And it just didn't even cross our minds. And the beauty and the people again was, I mean, the food was pretty filthy and I got quite ill, but I was smart enough to bring baked beans with me. And I think that was probably the most insulting thing I could have done. So I would sort of go around, I'd hide around the back of a little village house or something, and I'd, you know, try and stuff the baked beans into my mouth. And I remember Imran caught me, and it's the only time he ever got really cross with me, which is really quite right. So I sort of not only I insulted the food, the, you know, everything, but the hospitality, everything, just with that can of baked beans. But I going back to your question, I think, yeah, concentrate around the Karakoram Highway, and there are very good travel agents, sort of adventure travel agencies that you can go through. And I think it's quite developed by compared to how it was when I went there. I think there's some really lovely hotels there now. And obviously, if you're a climber, you know, there's you can get your permit and go and see K2 or wherever. But it's a ravishing part of the world.
Why do you think that you felt more authentic, more yourself than ever before there?
I think because I hadn't. I think probably because there was nothing to measure myself by that was familiar.
Right.
It was such an alien culture that, you know, there was no, I didn't think, oh, I have to do this or I need to do that, or everything was sort of different. And so you could only be yourself.
So it was quite a liberating space.
Yes, it was. It was. It really was. And just the, you know, the people I made so many friends out there, and I'm still in contact with. And it's like, you know, when are you coming home? They'll contact me and go, when are you coming home? When are you coming home? And that's what it was like.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries. Well, we move on then to chapter 4, and that is the big one, your all-time favorite destination. Such a hard one. Which comes to mind today?
Well, there are two. I've got two.
And I'm very happy with two, unless you want to push yourself and hone it down.
Okay, well, we're going to fly back from the other side of the world now, from east and west, and we are going to end up in Cornwall.
Oh, gorgeous Cornwall.
And we are going to the south coast of Cornwall onto the Helford River, the Helford Passage. And we go there. We've been going every year since the children were tiny. It's so wonderful to see how it's right on the Jurassic coast. So there's amazing walking and stuff. But it's the way the English countryside just falls into the sea. So, you know, to see oak trees right by the sea is extraordinary. And it's there's something, I think you either get Cornwall or you don't. And it's not North Cornwall where you've got Polzeath and, you know, which is where all the kids wanted to be. They now appreciate South Cornwall. But it's an extraordinarily maternal place. And if you have a disposition to tap into that, it's very nurturing. And that's what I found. I feel, again, it's like going into a warm embrace when I go to Cornwall. And it can be so wild and windy. We were just down there. It was like 70 mile an hour wind, but it still had that magic. And again, you know, the light changes and it's so clear and the water is crystal clear. And I just love the sort of contrast in energy of this peaceful calm and then this raging fury that can happen in a heartbeat. So I feel very safe there, but I also feel very alive. And I love to see my family going through the same emotions and how they feel the same. They don't articulate it, but I can see, you know, it's like their spirits are ignited almost. It's hard to describe.
Honestly, what a beautiful depiction of what Cornwall can awaken in us.
It's magical. When I'm writing, you know, if I'm writing a book or whatever, I will always go down to Cornwall on my own, and it's where I write.
So it inspires, it's an inspiring destination creatively.
Yes, it is. And again, it's that freedom, and where, you know, where we go, we're not in the midst of hundreds of people. It's like wherever we go, we're always looking to get as far away from people as possible. And there you have the choice. You know, you can go, and so it's great for the children. They can go off and meet friends or make friends. And we have an ancient old rib that we keep down there with a friend who lives down there, and we use that, which means we can go off to wherever. You know, to beaches and not have to go on the road, because you know what Cornwall's like. There are so many inlets, so it might take you 30 seconds to cross the river or a bay. Yes, it's going to take you 3 hours to drive around it.
Totally.
And it's just, we have this really ancient old rib that was it's an ex-RNLI boat. And my God, I mean, we are so not health and safety. I mean, the children were like tiny, no life jackets, nothing. The dog always getting tipped out of the boat, not knowing the tides, trying to get the boat into a beach. But now we kind of mastered it a little bit more. But it's just, yeah, it's just simple. It's a simple life. It's a wonderful, beautiful, simple life. And it's, you know, it's because I know it so well, it is like going home.
Well, before we move on to your hidden gem, chapter 5, very quickly, what was your other all-time fave?
The other is Scotland. So north and south, in particular the Cairngorms, and up by Blair Athol, there's a river going up in near Blair Athol called the Tilt River, and there's a glen called Glen Tilt, and walking up there, and to me, it feels like the last wilderness left in this country. And you see the deer, and you see, you know, the red deer, and you see the golden eagles, you see hares, you see grouse, you see snipe. It's just, and you can get very easily, dangerously lost. And it's exhausting to walk through, you know, up those hills. And, yeah, and the heather at certain times of year, and the air, and again, the brutality of the weather and how it can change very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So you, in a way, it's like, that's another, why I loved Antarctica, is that, you know, we have no control over the weather. And so it's a real lesson in acceptance. You've just got to accept what comes along and deal with it.
I should have spoken to you before or while I was out in Portugal last week, Susanna, when we had 9 days of rain, because I was really struggling with that acceptance.
I would have been pissed off too. I'm not going to lie. 9 days.
Yeah.
I read about that. Actually, that was over Easter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, you poor thing. I'm so sorry. Yeah. That's awful, Holly.
It was frustrating. It was frustrating because I was seeing all these beautiful environments, but I just didn't feel as though I could fully experience them and like get under their skin because I was inhibited by the weather. But it was one of those, you know, you've got to just get on with it, don't you?
But the thing is, though, you go to Portugal for the weather, for good weather and sunshine. You go to Scotland and you expect it.
This is true.
That freezing cold, windy and rain. And you go, I would have spent 9 days being bitter, twisted and resentful. So
I know now I've got to plan another trip. That's the thing. That's the silver lining.
You must.
I've got to go away again. Well, chapter 5 is your hidden gem. Now that is a place, I mean, that part of Scotland is definitely a hidden gem for sure. But it is a place that you love that my listeners might not know so much about.
That would be, Holly, I'm going to go to Italy now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go right down to the south, to the ball of the foot, to Calabria. And there is the nearest town when we've been there. There's been a town called Soverato. And nearby, and I can't remember, there was like Anthony Gormley. No one knows about this, but there was an Anthony Gormley installation in these orange groves, and we just drove by. I don't think anyone knew anything about it. It was just there.
My goodness.
And then we rented a little villa. A little teeny weeny little house with all the kids. And we went back there about we've been there about 3 times. This is when the kids were small again. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible because we were close to the sea and there was like this 60 mile long beach with no one on it. No one. And we'd walk through these orange groves, and the place where we rented the little house, the owner, she lived in a bigger house, and she'd give us a key to get onto the beach because you walk through these orange groves and then you'd have a key to get onto the beach, but you could get through other ways. And it was just, it was extraordinary. It's an extraordinary place. I mean, I haven't been there for, you know, quite a few years, but it was stuck in a time warp and there was no shops really. It's a mafia stronghold down there. And so they were doing, you know, all these sort of partly finished buildings because then you didn't have to pay the tax on when you complete the buildings, and that was kind of a known thing. So with the sort of breeze blocks everywhere and half finished apartment blocks, but you'd get to where we stayed, it was in this sort of little, you know, it was all kind of had pine trees around it, and the pine trees which hold pine cones hold the pine nuts. And that, you know, perfect weather, this incredible beach, and no one there, and we didn't hear an English voice or anything other than Italian spoken the whole time, every time we were there.
How did you find that? How did you choose it?
Through a great friend of ours she was married to an Italian, and so it was through them.
In the know. Interesting.
In the know, yeah.
Love that. Love a native recommendation like that. I guess that part, well, Puglia, of course, is now extremely popular, but Calabria, I think, is slightly like still much more under the radar. So
I mean, there's not much to do there. I can understand. I mean, maybe, you know, the last time we went there was probably about 15 years ago. So maybe it's evolved since then, but you know, there was like villages up in the mountains behind, and you'd look in a shop window and there was sort of like a packet of sanitary towels from the 50s was covered in dust for sale. I mean, literally nothing had moved on. And so there was not much to do. It hadn't become, it wasn't they weren't catering to tourists at all.
Right. So it's for a really authentic local experience.
Yeah. Yes. But there was, you know, it's kind of flat down by the coast, and the coastline wasn't so interesting, and the sea was always very calm. But you're very, if you want sun, good value, then I recommend it. Hopefully it's the same as it was when we went there.
Love that recommendation. Thank you so much. Well, in very much a contrast to that, our penultimate chapter is the place you would never go back to, or your very worst travel experience. What comes to mind for that?
Worst travel experience I had going to another continent now was flying out to Nairobi. And I was probably about 24. Flying out to Nairobi, and I thought I had, well, I did have a really bad hangover, and I thought I had an upset stomach. Anyway, it turned out to be appendicitis.
Oh, God.
So I got appendicitis, so I was like thinking it was still, well, I didn't know it at the time. I thought I had some sort of, you know, gastric bug, so I was drinking brandy on the flight. And then we landed, and I went with a great friend of mine whose uncle lived out there, and he kind of did safaris and that kind of thing. And the safari, you know, our travels were delayed, I can't remember why, for 12 hours, because we were going to get off the plane and head straight out, and it was delayed for some reason. And during that time, I got full-blown appendicitis, screaming.
Oh, poor thing.
And
how scary.
It was quite scary, and so I was taken to hospital, and Nairobi Hospital. They were incredible, but they were so paranoid. So I had basically my appendix burst. So I got bad peritonitis, but enough for them to be worried. And I remember that when on the way there, all I remember is that this guy, Anthony Seth Smith, saying, well, you've got a choice of a surgeon. You can have Killer Miller or Bloody Mary. And I said, you know, I was like, as if I cared. I was just like, get the fucking thing out. And anyway, so I had my appendix out, and it was, they'd pump you with antibiotics because obviously, you know, very, very fearful of infection. And it was so agonizing having these antibiotics put in my blood. I remember I had they didn't give me any painkillers. They wouldn't give you any painkillers for some reason. I had anesthetic to have the appendix out. And I remember having a cardboard box by my bed. And then there was a guy next door to me who'd been attacked by a lion.
Oh my gosh.
His face had all been. And he was like a ranger, I think. And he was so sweet. And he said to me, you know, just get something that you can hit. And so I got this, the nurses brought me this cardboard box filled with empty Coke bottles. So it was sturdy. And I just stabbed this box with a biro. I remember stabbing it. And then I recovered very quickly. And then we went off on our travels. And then.
What, you carried on and went on your safari afterwards?
Yeah, carried on and went on safari.
Oh my goodness.
And I was so skinny, I lost so much weight very, very quickly. I probably was in the hospital for about 4 days or a week. And we went on, and I remember Anthony saying to me, you know, if we'd gone and this had happened, you would have been fine. And I said, well, how could I possibly have been fine? He said, we would have taken the appendix out. We would have got soldier ants to have bitten the wound clean. So they would bite the wound clean, and they'd take the bodies off the heads to leave the heads in, and you wouldn't have got infection. I mean, I'm telling you all this and it sounds like I'm absolutely bullshitting, but it's totally true.
I'm like, so was she hallucinating from sepsis here? Yeah. Wow.
So, but it was an amazing, it turned out to be, you know, an incredible trip.
God, what an unbelievable experience. There's nothing worse than being ill in another country, but I'm so thrilled that you then were able to go and, you know, experience the beauty of Kenya, and it hasn't left a negative memory in your mind.
Love to go back.
The biro box.
Well, the biro box saved me. It was amazing.
Well, Susanna, I've just absolutely loved crossing like all these continents with you, going all around the world with you. The final chapter of your travel diaries is chapter 7, and that is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list.
The destination that's at the top of my travel bucket list is Antarctica, and I have been there. So where do I go from this? I don't know. So in going to Antarctica with Viking, on Octantis, on their expedition ship, was every dream that I've had since a little girl. Mm. I was a little girl, realised. You know, we were a bit reluctant about going on a cruise because we had all the sort of, you know, cliched misconceptions about cruising, that everyone was going to be ancient.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask if you'd been on one before.
Too many people, yeah. Never. And
yeah. So what was your experience
mind
like?
Mind-blowing. Every element of it, the boat, the staff, the other guests, the way it was organized. The only thing that was appalling was, if anyone who's listening, never fly on Iberia. I hope they're not sponsoring you. Never fly on Iberia. You have to be, you know, I'm a size 12-14. Really, I felt I could only fly in economy if I was a size 6 or 8. So you could barely get into the seat. There was chewing gum, spat out chewing gum in the pocket in front, which got all over my laptop. Oh. I mean, the whole thing was horrendous. But
so this was flying from London to...
Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they lost our luggage. And then we fly from there to BA to Ushuaia.
Ushuaia.
But... we lost our luggage, didn't turn up, and I was thinking, okay, well, what are we, you know, it's one thing going on a beach holiday, but when you're going to Antarctica, it's something quite different.
It's not like you can quickly hop back and get it.
No, I was just looking at the other guests and thinking, okay, who's my size? Okay, well, I'll probably fit into his trousers, I'll probably fit into her shoes, and it would have been quite a bit of a missed opportunity. It would have been fun to borrow one thing off every guest on the boat. But it was extraordinary, and nothing can prepare you for your first sight of Antarctica.
I hear this. I've heard this from so many travel journalists and from some of my guests. So what can you find the words to help me get an idea about what it actually is that seems to be so moving for a traveller?
I think it's the immensity, the vastness. I think that's the first thing. You know, you are on the peninsula, you know, in the northern part, on the Antarctic Peninsula, whatever it's called. You are there, which that is a pinprick on the continent, that peninsula.
Yeah.
But you are then a pinprick on the peninsula, and you've got a landmass which is twice the size of Australia before you.
Yeah.
And you feel it, but you're just seeing a teeny weeny tiny little dot of it. And it is huge and endless and not even wild. It's not wild. It's just pure. It's probably like, you know, if you lose your virginity, you know you're going to get that back. I think it's like almost like being a virgin again. You know, it's like if we had the ability to do that. It was just... The silence, the
purity.
Truly mind-blowing.
Yeah.
The purity was the big thing, and just everything was the clarity. Everything was so clear. You know, you can be in Wales or Scotland or anywhere and just think, my God, it's so – or the south of France where they have that special light and just think, this is mesmerizing. But you haven't seen – anything until you've seen the continent of Antarctica. I imagine it's a bit like seeing the Earth from space for the first time. It was very emotional. I burst into tears, and I never cry when we saw it for the first time. And the dignity of the continent and the humility as us as guests with the privilege of being able to go there felt You know, it was truly a humbling experience.
How was your Drake's Passage crossing? Because I've heard that that can be a little bit challenging.
I think it was, let's say zero's flat, you know, the lake, Drake Lake, and 10 is the Drake shape. We were probably on a 6.
Okay.
So it was, you know, it was like that. And I took some Quells, you know, seasick pills, because the patches don't work. So if you're going, don't take patches because they're a complete waste of time. Just take proper full-on medication.
Is it something you just kind of like grin and bear because you know that you're getting to the other side, or do people freak out?
No one freaked out. I mean, it wasn't that bad. No one freaked out, and there's nothing you can do about it. And the staff and the crew are so reassuring, and they're so... I mean, for me, that probably, apart from the continent itself, it was the crew members on the expedition ship that was the most memorable thing. They were so knowledgeable. And, you know, they've probably been asked the same question over and over again, but every question you asked was kind of treated like something they'd never thought about before. And the way the boat is designed is... I think it's really only the Scandinavians can do it well. It's sort of clean lines. They can make clean lines very cozy.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. that's not sort of oxymoron, but, you know, with the reindeer rugs and then sort of chrome and leather, there was nothing flashy about it or glitzy. It's really beautifully, tastefully, elegantly done.
Yeah.
But you don't feel there's anything wrong about spending all day and night in your thermals and wandering around in slippers.
Yeah.
Which is what we did.
And how long was your journey? How long were you on the boat for?
We were on the boat for 10 days, or 12 days. Mm-hmm. It really was a trip of a lifetime. And I think it's, looking back at that, it was probably the first holiday I've ever had, because we had, in terms of relaxing, because we had no children there. There were no children on the boat either. And I love children, but it was quite nice to be child-free for a bit.
Yeah.
And everything was taken out of your hands, as much as it was, you know, the captain who didn't know what the weather was going to bring, and they had to change plans. You know, within 5 minutes you'd be heading somewhere and then there'd be a storm coming, so you'd have to go somewhere else. And so you just had to go with the flow and let it all happen. They have 2 submarines, which... you know, and I went down, steam was too scared, which made me really happy. And there's this thing called a phantom jellyfish. And there'd only been, the first sighting was actually from a submarine on either Octantis or Polaris, one of the Viking expedition ships. And it's this massive, sort of ghost-like creature, looks like a jellyfish, which is about 30 foot long. And they have these,
oh my gosh,
5 tentacles that come out, which aren't actually tentacles like an octopus. They're actually 5 mouths that they have. And it was this sort of ethereal thing, like a giant tapeworm came by. And that was from the submarine. So that was very exciting to see
what
that.
What an
and
experience.
If you love nature, you...
It's the place.
It's just to see whales, just to see... You know, we'd run around the boat. I'd run around the boat. And you'd be running along cold, all wrapped up and running. And be like, oh, look, there's a humpback whale. Oh, my goodness, there's a pod of orcas. Oh, look at that seal. You know, a little penguin on that ice floe. And then... it was, you know, there was so much to look at. It was a feast for the eyes. Every moment, every second, whether you were inside the boat with the incredible art that's on the walls or you were outside looking at nature, it was, I mean, you can probably hear in my voice exceptional it was.
Thank you so much, Susanna, for being so generous with your time and so beautifully evocative with your travels. Those were your magnificent travel diaries. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure, Holly. Thank you so much for inviting me. Been amazing. Thank you.
Oh, doesn't Antarctica sound amazing? A huge thank you to Susanna for joining me on the podcast. Susanna was on a Viking cruise to Antarctica, and Viking provides destination-focused journeys on rivers, oceans, and lakes across all seven continents and expeditions in Antarctica, the Arctic, and North America's Great Lakes. All of them to add to our bucket list, hey? And you can find Susanna's podcast, My Wardrobe Malfunction, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait till then, remember there's the first 10 seasons to catch up on. That's over 115 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.